So happy to have you here sharing your Thanksgiving with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller, and so happy and feeling pretty privileged to be able to carry on the tradition of bird watching shows on Thanksgiving and carrying on the tradition of having Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright as our guests. Bill Volkert recently retired as a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you. And I guess from a couple of bird guides, happy Turkey Day.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are a lot of birds in the oven, and we can talk about watching other birds. And Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and he is also joining us by phone. Hi, Noel.
Hi, Judith. Of all the holidays that we do, Thanksgiving is always my favorite, so it's great to be with you once again.
And I've heard from people that that they really look forward to this particular show every year. So we're happy to have both of you, and we are happy to have all of you listeners joining us as well. And you can also join us by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Amanda Magnus is our on-air producer today, and she will get your calls and emails in to us. So tell us what you've seen as far as bird activity goes and what you're curious about. Bill and Noel will probably have an answer for you. So Bill and Noel, it's been a really spectacular fall season for vagrants with some rarer first-time sightings in Wisconsin. Bill, why don't you tell us first about the Inca dove?
Well, that's actually a bird that's common in the far southwest Mexico and into Central America. And we've had a few of these southern doves show up in Wisconsin in the last couple of years now. White-tipped dove was another one that showed up, recorded not too long ago. And we're here in Wisconsin, being a northern state. We have the mourning dove, of course, its close relative, the extinct passenger pigeon, and then the imported rock pigeon or rock dove or what we call common pigeon. That's all we have. But actually, that whole family of pigeons and doves is very diverse, and especially as you get into the subtropics and tropics, it's a tremendously large family much further south. So there's a couple of wonders that actually made it up here in a first state record for us.
And there were also some rare flycatchers that were spotted this year.
I'll let Noel handle a couple of those.
Yeah, just back on the Inca dove for a second.
Sure.
It showed up at Concordia University in Mequon, which is right along the Lake Michigan shoreline. A lot of the birds that have been showing up have been found along the lake shore. It seems like there are many of the ones we've had this fall have come in from the west, southwest, and they'll reach the shoreline, and that's where they put down. So we had the Inca dove at Concordia, but then out farther north, we had a sistertail flycatcher in Kewaunee County. It was there for more than a week. Someone going to look for it because the directions are broadcast electronically these days, so people can go out and try to find some of these birds. And while one person was looking for the scissor-tailed flycatcher, found a western kingbird.
Hmm.
And then at Coleandre Park, which is kind of in between where the Inca dove was and where the scissor-tailed flycatcher was, they found a Sais phoebe. It was actually photographed on the beach at Coleandre. So those are three different flycatchers, all western species, all extremely rare in the state, and showed up. And, of course, our neighboring states have been finding some of these, too. So it's been an extraordinary fall for vagrants, especially western species that never have made it to Wisconsin before, or only a few times.
Was there also a vermilion flycatcher spotted?
Yes, and it's still being found. It's out in Rock County at Muskrat Lake. Some people have been very successful finding it quite close to the road. This is kind of a small lake that you can use a telescope to see all the way around it, but the bird is moves around quite a bit around the lake. It perches low, and there's a lot of dead vegetation around the lake, flies back and forth between perches and the ground. So sometimes it's very readily visible, other times not at all. But it's been now for a couple weeks, and it's an adult male, so it's beautiful red and black. And we've had a few of them in the state before, but it's probably been one of the most exciting, if not the most exciting, bird. It is the sixth state record that we've had in Wisconsin, so it's made it here a couple times before. Also in Ozaukee County is a broad-billed hummingbird.
Hmm.
I think that's the second state record, isn't it?
What, Bill?
The second state record. We had one in Waupun.
In Waupun, that's right.
Four years ago, 5 years ago, something like that.
And the person's house that it was found in, he was able to go to see the one in Mequon. He said it's a quite of a vocal hummingbird. It makes sounds. In fact, I went to see it a few days ago, and I heard it before I saw it. He had that so etched in his mind because it came to his house in Waupun for several days, and he went to photograph the bird at in Mequon, and he said, it sounded like a broadbill to me. So, and it's still there. So,
going back to the flycatchers, that's not a species that I'm familiar with. Can you tell us a little more about what they do and what they are and their size and stuff like that?
It's a huge family of birds. And again, Wisconsin, we've got a nice representation of flycatcher species. They're almost all summer residents here. As you get down into the tropics, oh gosh, you get into some of the countries in South America, they've got 75 to 100 species of flycatchers. So they really explode in the tropics. But they tend to have overall a habit of perching, watching for insects that are flying, swooping out and grabbing them out of the air. And that's where the name flycatcher comes from.
So they're catching things on the fly.
Yes, yeah. That tends to be their habits. Some of these birds, such as the phoebe, does switch over to berries as a diet before they depart, so they can stick around a little later than the insect hatch. And, of course, it raises a question for a bird sticking around this late. They have to have a little bit of a diverse diet since the insects are pretty well gone. It does raise an interesting question. Obviously, this is the exceptional year that apparently the winds or something picked these birds up and brought in such a variety. But we also have more people watching and much better communication these days. And it does always raise a question in my mind is, are these birds this exceptionally rare and first-time occurrences, or is this just the first time we've ever really noticed them and the word's been out among the professionals to actually document them?
So they may be here for the first time, or it just may be the first time that people are getting information that allows them to actually go out and spot them.
Yeah, I think it was after our last show, Noel and I talked a little bit, and I said, you know, it was interesting when you look back at some of the historical records, some of the rarest birds in the state always showed up in the backyards of the best bird watchers.
So there you go, because they knew what they were looking for.
Recognize them. But what we're getting, Noel and I both, and a lot of others, are by email photographs of things. I don't know what it is. Well, in the past, unless you were connected with a bird club, you look at something, it appears strange, I don't know what it is, I ask my neighbor, I ask a friend, they're not bird watchers, and it just simply vanishes. Now, you've got a chance to post that, get it out, and somebody can actually verify these things, and because of that, again, people who are not avid bird watchers have a chance to ask a much bigger audience.
Right.
And that's why I say that all the records were always in the best bird watchers' backyard because they're the ones who would recognize the birds.
Well, the hummingbird is kind of a case in point because the couple who was hosting the hummingbird at their house posted a message about, we still have a late ruby-throated hummingbird hanging around our house. And I'm sure others said, well, you better take a close look at it because this would really, really be late for ruby-throated. And this is the time of season when you expect some of these western vagrants to show up. And sure enough, they took a closer look at it and said, yeah, it doesn't look like a ruby-throated. And people started showing up, and some excellent photographs were taken. And as Bill mentioned, they were circulated instantaneously on the Internet, and people can start weighing in on bill shape and bill color and whether a tail feather is notched or not. And some of these, when you start dealing with immature birds or female hummingbirds, some of the identification gets to be pretty tough. But, identification was made in just a day or so, and people have been going to see the bird. So it's a combination of factors. I think more awareness, better communication. But I think this particular fall, there was some reason why more southwestern species was moving, whether misoriented or dispersing. And who knows what the drought conditions down in the Texas area might have on movements of birds.
That's a good point. They might have had to go further than they usually would looking for hospitable habitat or food.
Right.
Well, and actually, that's that conversation about being able to share information more readily and being able to get help on identifying things is a great reminder to our listeners that if you have a photo of a bird that you're curious about or just want to share, you can go to our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. E-R, The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook, and post a photo there. And we will be happy to take a look. And both Noel and Bill have access to that today, too. So if you put a photo up and you're curious about a bird, they will be able to take a look and discuss it. You can also join the conversation by phone by calling 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And Keith in Dodgeville has a question for you, too. So let's go to the phones. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I have a mystery I was hoping you could solve. We have a family of barn swallow that live on our porch, upstairs porch. And although we argue with them about whose porch it is, we've left them there because they eat a lot of bugs. Anyway, I was gone over the weekend this summer. I came back, and I found a drift of downy white feathers across the lawn and up on the roof, a handful of them. And I noticed later on that day that the only barn swallow left was the male.
Hmm.
And so my question is it possible to identify a bird from a handful of feathers?
It is if you have the wing or tail feathers or sometimes some of the prominent breast feathers where you've got a distinctive color. If you have just simply the down feathers, the undercoat, that gets to be much more challenging, if not almost impossible. And I would think that probably DNA testing, which, of course, would be laborious and expensive, would be the only way to confirm that. But, wing and tail feathers are fairly easy, and I pick them up periodically and identify what has either molted or been killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, these were feathers that I would have associated with an owl if they hadn't been snowy white. They had the tips of some of them had a little guard feather on it, and they had little tinges of tan. But otherwise, they're all pure snow white.
I was guessing that the feathers were actually from the barn swallows, not from whatever the predator was. Bill and Noel, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's what the question is whether this would indicate predation. But again, whatever you have for feathers, wing, tail, and probably the breast feathers are the most diagnostic and distinctive among a lot of the birds. In fact, there is a new book out on bird feathers that was published recently. Might help. The other thing I would suggest is, again, you can photograph those and you could circulate them or post them and we could take a look at it. I will remind you that possession of feathers, however, is protected by federal law. So you can't start making a bird feather collection.
Do you know whether barn owls prey on other birds? Because that was the only one that I would have associated with this color.
Well, barn owls are essentially pretty much gone out of Wisconsin, and they're almost entirely small rodent eaters, so they would never come in and take, a barn swallow around a residence like that. They're just not adapted to prey on that. And as Bill mentioned, there is an excellent field guide that more or less it came out on bird feathers this year. I don't know the title of it right off my hand, but it's
simply called Guide to North American Species Bird Feathers.
Okay.
Guide to North American Species Bird Feathers.
Yeah, the authors are Scott and McFarland.
Interesting. And we actually, Larry interviewed the author of a book called Feather, and it's about the architecture, basically, of feathers. And that was a fascinating show as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for that call, Keith. Sorry we weren't able to give you a little more information. But Bill and Noel, there was also a western tanager that was spotted in Ozaukee County, I believe.
And that was up around Merrill, I believe, Judith. And it came to a feeder. I mean, feeders at in the fall are really great places, of course, to attract any kind of birds. Well, a lot of time these rarities will show up at a feeder. And I don't know if it's still there or not, but I know it was there for a few weeks. And, again, some wonderful pictures were taken of it. And, again, another species of Western heritage. You know, neighboring states have had some interesting things, too, like a Scots Oriole down along the Chicago lakefront. There's a sage thrasher. And just a couple of miles south of the Wisconsin border at Illinois Beach State Park is a mountain bluebird. So it's just and that's what's needed. We talked about communication earlier that not only do we hear about what might be right next door to you because someone gets on their computer, but you hear what's in neighboring states, and you can start seeing some patterns. And one of the patterns, in fact, changing a topic just slightly, this looks like it's shaping up to be an excellent year for snowy owls to come into Wisconsin. And over the last week, there's been a dozen or so sightings of snowy owls all the way down to the Illinois border. And in fact, some people are starting to plot them on a map so we can kind of keep track of where all the snowy owls are showing up. So it appears to be it's going to be a great year for them to come into the state. Of course, they're coming in from the Arctic.
Wow.
So.
Well, I have never seen a snowy owl, and I would very much like to. Where should I think about going, maybe, to see one?
Well, there's been one in the marina at Sheboygan for the last week or so. And there has been a couple seen on the, like on the breakwater off McKinley Marina in Milwaukee. Ashland had several, and there's also been a couple inland. Inland records. I can't remember off the top of my head where they've been. Very often, one will show up at Horicon.
Oh. The big open sweeps, central right. Wisconsin, south of Stevens Point, and that Horicon Marsh up toward Lake Winnebago. As Noel said, this is an Arctic breeder, so they tend to come down to the areas of. Kind of flat, wide open, our farmlands and lacking in trees, or the Lake Michigan, Lake Superior shorelines seem to be the most favored sightings.
And for owls, is there a time of day that it's better to see them?
That's an unusual one because most of our owls are nocturnal, which makes it so hard to actually observe them.
Mm-hmm.
Snowy owls, of course, they're breeding up in the Arctic, and during the summer they've got 24-hour daylight. So they tend to be a little more active during the daytime hours than other owls are. So they are a little bit more observable. They also tend to have a habit of, every year we may get one or two immatures that head out looking for food and may show up in the northern states. But about every fourth year, we tend to get a bit of an invasion, and that's because their primary food, the lemming, goes through a four-year population cycle. So when they run out of food, they all bail out of the Arctic and come down here. So these are birds that can adapt to and withstand some of the coldest temperatures of the Arctic as long as there's food.
Wow.
When lemmings crash, they're heading down.
Well, that's good for us down here.
Yeah. Finally get to see them.
It's the Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. We're talking about birds with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. You can join in, too, by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this Thanksgiving day for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned. So nice to be spending Thanksgiving with all of you here on the Larry Mueller Show talking about birds with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They are happy to answer your questions and also to help you ID some birds you might have seen. If you took a picture, put it up on our Facebook page and we'll all take a look at it. And Bill and Noel will be able to give you their advice. So let's go to Bob in Stevens Point. Hi, Bob.
There's a bird that shows up every, I'd say October to now. I don't know seagulls because here in the middle of the state, we don't really have that many big seagulls. It's high-flying, and it's soaring, and it makes a peep. You can hear it. What am I looking at?
There are two primary gulls that we see in large numbers in the fall and also into the winter in Wisconsin. The smaller is the ringbill gull. And I've noticed in the last 20 years that these birds seem to have picked up a habit of coming inland when the farmers are plowing their fields, which brings up the insects, grubs, and food source for them, and they'll take advantage of that. And also they're hitting some of the inland lakes before they freeze over. So ringbill gull is the most likely. Later on in the season, oftentimes we'll also see the larger herring gull. So those are the two main gulls. Now, if you get out to Lake Michigan or Lake Superior coastline in wintertime, you'll see the bird watchers out there looking for some of the rarer gulls coming from the north, Glaucus gull, Iceland gull, and I'll tell you right now, identifying gulls can be a real challenge. So that's sometimes kind of the intermediate to advanced course for bird watchers. They can be challenging that way. But, those are the most common ones that I would expect, especially the ringbill coming in.
No, they're smaller, just high flying. I've never seen them over our ponds, or I drive by enough fields, or sitting out there.
Yeah, as Bill mentioned, they like to feed in earthworms and other invertebrates they can find during cultivation in the fall. But also with our landfill systems, they'll very often frequent that and go back and forth between bodies of water and landfills, or your local McDonald's or parking lots at a Walmart, wherever they can find a few French fries or whatever. So they've become very adaptable and have moved inland a whole lot more than what they used to be when they were pretty much restricted to really large bodies of water. And they'll often soar, you know, quite high, as you mentioned, and they will call occasionally. So most likely, if you're in Stevens Point, it's probably a ring-billed, but Bill mentioned also it could be a herring gull.
Thanks for that call, Bob. And let's go to Paul in Belmont. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering, is there a website you're talking for the snowy owls that where you would post the locations where you spot the birds and stuff like that that you guys use?
There is a website. In fact, I just looked at it this morning. I don't have it right at the tip, but before we get through, I'll make sure that Judith has that. And that'll give her a chance maybe to go out and find one of these birds, too.
Absolutely. It's definitely on my list now.
I'll definitely get it posted here before we hang up today.
Great. Yeah, so Paul.
Under the Wisconsin Birding Network.
Wisconsin Birding Network.
Yeah, it's kind of an online discussion group, and you can find the webpage where the posts are. Or if you're really into it, you can subscribe to it, and you can get these updates regularly as bird watchers are both citing things or debating identification of birds and so forth.
Great. And we will definitely get that Wisconsin Birding Network link up on the Facebook page before the end of the show, and we'll also read it on the air. So
but there's a specific website where someone is going in and actually creating maps, and people can add their locations to the map. So it's kind of a special feature of the eBird system that we have right now.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I think it's, you know, there's so many ways that technology has changed our lives and things like this. You know, someone like me who is interested in birds but, you know, isn't involved in those networks, I wouldn't really know where to find that information or even know that that information was out there. So this is really great. Actually, let's go to Sarah in Zion, Illinois, because she has an owl question too. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, I do have an owl question. And I realize it's way too late. Is there an echo? Because I'm getting an echo.
There's a little, but that's fine.
Okay. Several years ago up on the Gunflint Trail in Minnesota, I did see this owl in the middle of the day. And I'm curious. You said it was really unusual to see owls that aren't snowy owls in the daytime. Just how unusual is that? Because it was snowing really hard, so I couldn't tell what kind of owl it was. I mean, to me it looked all white, but there was a blizzard.
What do you guys think?
Well, again, you know, they tend to have a habit to hunt in the evening time. I do see them occasionally during the daytime, especially when it's overcast. I'm assuming sometimes if they're having tough luck in hunting, you've got ground cover, maybe a low rodent population, they haven't eaten for a few days, sure, they're going to try to hunt. And there is a good chance as you're getting, you said Gunflint Trail, getting that far north, you may also have then the great gray owl or even hawk owl, which is another one that tends to be a little more active during the daytime. So these are some of the more uncommon ones. Otherwise, great horned and barred owl, screech owl, those are the three that are the most commonly that are seen or heard.
All right. Thanks for that call, Sarah.
And Judith, I do have the website here.
Great. What is that?
Jesse Ellis has been working on this, and it's a Google Maps map, and it's got a very long address, but he has shortened it, and it's an http://backslash website, mm-hmm. and tinyurl, tinyurl, .com, /. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the critical seven letters and one
okay.
number. C as in cut right, X, D as in daydream, V as in Victor, J as in Jack, D as in David, 8.
All right, we will get that up on the website. And just to repeat that, it's http://// tinyurl.com/CXDVJD8.
That's it.
All right, we will get that up. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Pat in Rudolph next. Hi, Pat.
Hi, I'm so glad you're doing this today. My husband and I found a baby bird on Tuesday in our yard in the leaf litter, and I have pictures of it. I'm having trouble sending them to you, but I'm working on it.
Okay.
And I think it must be a woodpecker. On the picture, I can see the wingtips and the tail, and they're black and white. But the bird is little and fluffy and sort of yellowish. And he had his head down and his turned around and down on his back. And I think this is kind of unusual.
What do you guys think?
Well, this would be very strange to have a young bird yet at this time of the year. They should all have either the full, if it takes 2 years for them to get the adult plumage, they should have that full juvenile plumage, or a lot of the birds have assumed the adult plumage by now. Oftentimes, you know, things like downy woodpecker or even our sapsuckers, in the hand, they can look quite small. So, you know, sometimes these birds, when they're perched, they tend to fluff up their feathers, look a little larger. When you actually get them in a hand, they sometimes appear a little smaller than what you might think. So I'm guessing probably one of the smaller species of woodpeckers rather than an immature bird.
Well, we have both downy and hairy,
okay.
And this is a baby. It's about the size of a chickadee, and the body is pale, yellowish, tan, and downy, you know, fluffy.
Hmm.
And he wasn't happy. At one point, he was on a porch railing and breathing heavily, and then he kind of jumped, flew with teeny little wings.
Well, if you do have a good photo, you could post that. That would be great. That would really help us, and I'm sure Noel and I would be able to get a good look at that and help you out.
Right, or Pat, you could also email that photo to talk@WPR.org, and Amanda can get that up on the Facebook page if that's a little easier for you.
Okay, great.
Great, thank you. Guys, do you think it's possible that that's a sick bird?
It could very well be, and you know, woodpeckers shouldn't, small ones shouldn't have much of a yellowish to them, so until we get a chance to maybe look at it, this time of year, as Bill mentioned, there's very few species that still may have young around. Mourning doves or rock pigeons sometimes will nest over a very long period of time. But until the owls start up here soon, great horned owls, we actually have an egg record in December now. So, but November is really be highly unlikely to have a young bird. So. Just hope we can get a picture up, and Bill and I can take a look at it.
Yeah, well, again, Pat, you can email that to talk@WPR.org, and we'll get that up on the Facebook page, and Bill and Noel will take a look. Bill and Noel, is the fall migration over at this time of year? I know Larry and I were fortunate to go over to the La Crosse area, especially specifically Brownsville, Minnesota, a couple weeks ago for the Migrations with Mueller field trip with Craig Thompson from the DNR and Maria Sadowski from the Natural Resources Foundation. And we saw literally thousands of tundra swans. We saw green-winged teals, pintail ducks, a wood duck. I spotted a double-crested cormorant who Craig Thompson said shouldn't have been there. And there were thousands of birds on the Mississippi. But in general, is the fall migration about over at this point?
Well, I'll let Bill talk about waterfowl because he likes to do that. And there's still a lot of waterfowl movement. But, you know, other birds, we still have sparrows moving. And, of course, this time of year, just like the snowy owls coming down, we have a number of finches coming down from the north country. And they'll be with us probably all winter. So we've had good movements and reports already of both species of crossbills, red poles, common red poles, pine siskin. So there's definitely winter finches still on the move, along with snow buntings and lapping longspurs coming into the state. We have northern shrikes showing up along with the snowy owls. Plus some of our really hardy species. There's probably some sparrows that are still migrating. Maybe yellow-rumped warblers, our hardiest warbler. There's probably still a few of those moving around, kinglets. So some of the more hardy passerines are moving along with the winter finches, and Bill can speak to waterfowl movements.
Well, I also wanted to add that, you know, we do refer to this departure of birds as fall migration, and so I think most people associate that with September and October, which probably is the real peak for most bird movement. But we actually start seeing the first of the fall migrants in July already, and here we are toward the end of November. Sandhill cranes are still on the move.
Right.
The swans, as Noel mentioned, we've got a lot of the waterfowl here, and they're going to stick around as long as there's open water. The one point I always try to get across for people is that I hear a common expression that, well, it's getting cold outside and the birds have to go south. But, of course, birds are well insulated. It's not the cold that forces most of them out of here. It's really the lack of food. And so for the insect-eating birds, it was the frost that took out their food supply. For birds like the waterfowl, they can access food in the open water until the ice forms. And then for sandhill cranes and especially our Canada geese, they're tough birds. They can stick around pretty late in the season until the snow accumulates. So, yeah, we're well past the actual peak, but there are still birds on the move, and we'll see some of these stragglers hanging around as we do the Christmas bird count.
And we're definitely going to talk about that Christmas bird count. But I wanted to go back to what you were saying about the waterfowl when we were with Craig Thompson, a DNR biologist, looking at those waterfowl on the Mississippi. He was saying that, basically they would hang around until it started freezing over, and then most of them would be heading to the Chesapeake Bay. But that what we were seeing when we saw these little butts up in the air, or bigger butts in the case of the swans, was that they were going after the tubers at the bottom of those river grasses.
Well, each of the different ducks and geese and swans have a distinct diet. So some of them are going for the roots and tubers. Some are diving down for little fingernails, clams and snails. So there's really kind of a diversification among their diets. And this is why we can have so many species together in one open water area. It reduces the competition, kind of a basic rule of nature. So there's a little bit different food. The puddle ducks that tend to feed in the shallows and just reaching down for their food and also maybe sitting on the shallow wetlands, they get frozen out first. They'll be departing where we will see the diving ducks, those birds sitting out in the open water, remain well in the season, and some of them may just shift over to Lake Michigan where it never really freezes over, and we'll see winter ducks that remain there.
Hmm.
So it all has to do with food, and some of these birds are just the last ones are still able to access food now that the insects are long gone and before the ice forms or snow accumulates. And when we get to the winter finches, those birds, I don't know if I would consider that a true migration. We refer to these as invasions. They're nomads. When the nesting season is done, they go wherever the food is. And whether they stay in Canada, whether they show up in New York one year, they come to Wisconsin, or just kind of keep on the move throughout that entire season. This, again, it keeps the bird watching interesting. You never know during that slower time of the year which birds will be sticking around or coming into our area, and which ones maybe we have a little bit of a dearth of in some years.
So it sounds like the difference there with a migration, a true migration, I guess, they're actually on a particular route, starting one place, heading for another with various stops along the way. The invasion that you referred to is more they're just going wherever it looks the most hospitable.
Yeah, and I guess if you want to take a look at it for food, the true migrants run out of food entirely, and they depart. They bail out of here because there is nothing for them.
Mm-hmm.
The winter birds, they can still find food, but you have good seed crops in one region or another, and they're going to wherever that food might be available. Or if we have a very poor production of, say, cone crops or among the spruces and pines or even the birch trees for the different species for their food, when that is not available in Canada, they head out, and we get some good bird watching here in Wisconsin to mix things up.
Going back to that broad-billed hummingbird that you were saying was spotted pretty late, Carrie Jean on Facebook says, what would that hummingbird be eating this late in the season?
Well, it's still visiting late-blooming flowers, and at this particular house, they're feeding it. They still have hummingbird feeders out.
Ah, okay.
They even have it set up so they can make sure that their hummingbird feeders stay thawed out as the winter gets longer. And there's actually also some hummingbird mixtures you can make to add some protein to it. So I think they're looking into that because hummingbirds really catch a lot of insects, and that provides protein and other nutrients they need that the sugar water doesn't do a very good job supplying. So I think they're looking into trying to keep the bird going. And very often we always worry about these birds succumbing in really tough weather, but a lot of times they'll just decide, well, this is my time to go, and it'll pick up and head for Georgia or maybe the New Orleans coast. And we're just learning more and more about some of these western vagrants being more regular than what we ever thought. One time we thought that the only thing we ever had east of the Mississippi were ruby-throated hummingbirds, but we're learning that there may be some of these more westerns that kind of set up movements, and we're seeing more and more western species of hummingbird showing up in the eastern part of the country.
I'm imagining a lot of bird watchers around the state saying, oh, darn it, because they put their hummingbird feeder away earlier in the season. And now they're thinking, maybe if I had left it out, I would have gotten one of those vagrants visiting. But
yeah, that is a situation we always tell people. Don't take them down until you haven't seen a hummingbird for a couple weeks. But even then, there's chances you might miss them. But, you know, that's the way it goes.
Well, Mary posted a photo on Facebook that we'll get to in just a little bit. But I want to go to Rebecca in Platteville first. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Well, I got a couple questions here. One is I saw three, or maybe four, not positive, bluebirds at my water feeder, water, whatever, on the 6th of November, and I wanted to know if that was unusual. They all looked like they were males. And then two, I was in Austin, Texas about a week ago, and the Austins have a love-hate relationship, it seems, with grackles. And the grackles beg at you when you're at a bench, and people feed them, and they are everywhere, and they're really friendly. But the females look a little different than what I think our grackles look like. Are they the same? Anyway, they don't seem to act like that here.
It's the Southern hospitality.
Yes, there you go, there you go. And I'm going to add one more thing. 3 weeks ago, I saw two mourning doves mating, and I thought that was a little unusual. So those are my questions.
All right, well, let's have Bill and Noel address those. Maybe we should start with the mating mourning doves first.
Yeah, as I mentioned, doves are species that probably have just about the longest breeding record. You know, they'll start really late winter, early spring, and go all the way through late fall. So, and the fall has been pretty nice here. We've had some cold weather, but we've also had some decent weather. So I'm not sure that they would go ahead and lay eggs and try this late in the season. But and you found an amorous male and female, and they're going on. And so it doesn't surprise me that she saw it. It would be, you know, somewhat unusual, but it's a neat sighting to see. And I'll address the bluebirds, too.
Great.
We're seeing more and more bluebirds hanging on in the fall, I think, as our climate changes some. And for a number of years, we've been getting bluebirds on several of our Christmas bird counts now, which start here in about 3 weeks. So it's always nice to see them this late in the year, but it's not all that uncommon anymore to be able to see. And, of course, our populations are good, too. The Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin folks have really been working on getting good housing up for the last couple of decades, and our bluebirds have really rebounded in number. So we have more bluebirds, changes in our weather patterns, and of course more people out looking at them, and we're just seeing more bluebirds all into the late fall, even into early winter.
We had Dr. Bluebird on the show.
Yes, Kent Hall was
yes,
there.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for reminding me of his actual name, because I can only think of Dr. Bluebird. And I'm thinking, we're definitely going to talk about good gifts for bird watchers later, but I'm thinking a bluebird house might be a great gift.
It would be. Mm-hmm. Would be.
And then what about those friendly grackles?
Well, she mentioned down in Texas. Now, as you get down south, we've got the great-tailed grackle, and as you get more toward the southeast, also the boat-tailed grackle. So these are two birds that are much larger than our common grackles, and that's a possibility that she was probably running into some of the southern grackle species. She mentioned also a love-hate relationship with them as they're getting a little too friendly around some of the picnic areas. I think for any of these birds, when they become a nuisance, probably the first thing to do is have a ban on public feeding, because that is, of course, what lures the birds in, gives them a little bit of a bad habit. And then also, just for the sake of the birds, we also have the potential of spreading diseases among the population. So that's probably something for them to deal with on a local level. But, yes, there are different grackle species as you go further south, the bow-tailed and great-tailed grackle being the two main ones. And they are a little larger than ours, especially with these really massive tails. So that's probably the best way to identify them.
Well, thanks for those questions, Rebecca. And let's go to Mike in Crawford County next. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning and happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
To you, too.
I have two questions. I have one that was relating to a dead bird that I found in the yard here under a walnut tree. It was about the color of the backside tail and wing was about the color of a robin. Its beak was approximately the same length, although the breast was, if I remember right, a beige with a orange flex in it. And it reminded me of a young robin when he's just getting plumage. He's kind of fluffy with a little flex, but this bird was an old bird, I mean a mature bird, and it was upside down just laying there, and I wondered, it's kind of strange why it was there, and what kind of a bird was it, and that was one question.
Sure, why don't you ask the second one, too?
Okay, the second question is, where I'm at here in southwest Wisconsin, apparently there's always abundancy of most species of birds here at my feeder, although this last year, cardinals seem to be on the decline, and even juncos I had just, it was just lousy with them all over the place in the past. I think I've only seen four.
Hmm.
I'm wondering what's going on.
All right. Well, let's have Bill and Noel address those. Bill and Noel, do you have a sense of what that bird might have been that he found under the tree?
No. I'm trying to roll some things around in my head.
He said it was kind of beige with a spotted breast. Is that right, Mike?
It was, yeah. It was like little... The orange flecks in his breast were about the color of the orange that the full robin breast usually is, the orange. Maybe just a tad lighter. And they were in little flecks.
And was the back gray like a robin or more brownish?
As I recall, it was gray.
Because there are several other members of that same thrush family.
That's what I was thinking, too, was a thrush.
And, hermit thrush being the more likely to stick around late in the season. But hermit thrush, if you flip it over, he's got a very brownish back with a more reddish-brown tail to it. That's pretty diagnostic.
So it might have been a thrush.
And robin is a thrush, member of the thrush family.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps one of those relatives. But it wouldn't have a gray back.
Hmm.
Brown, you say? More brown.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike's second question?
On the juncos, they're just starting to come into the feeder.
They're just getting here.
Yeah, I just started noticing juncos in our backyard.
And, you know, a lot of people refer to them as a snowbird, and I think that's kind of an old folk name that they tend to show up when the snow flies. Well, the fact is, if you start driving country roads and start looking around, late September, early October, we start seeing the first junco showing up already. And they're sitting out there feeding on these roadsides, open fields, and forest edges scraping around because there's a lot of food available. Again, when the snow flies and it starts covering up the ground, they get drawn to the feeders because it's a lot easier picking. So they're already here, but they're not right now forced into the feeders because there's more than enough access to natural food.
And juncos feed off the ground a lot too, don't they?
Right, yeah. They tend to do a little scratching and looking for food. And that's why, once snow starts to accumulate, it gets a little tougher to try to find the food there on the ground. So perhaps give it a little bit of time, see what happens as the season advances and we start to get a little bit of snow and see if the juncos don't start showing up more.
Right.
You also mentioned about cardinals seem to be down a bit. Well, that could be a very local phenomenon. Cardinals right now, the population is doing quite well. They're widespread and abundant. May have been some changes right in the local neighborhood. And those are populations on a very local level. They can come and go.
Because I have to say, the cardinal population in Madison this year was huge.
Well, maybe all his moved cardinals.
Sorry about that, Mike. We'll try to send them back next year. It's the Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry today. Happy to be spending Thanksgiving with you and with our guests, Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. We're talking about birds, and you can join in, too, by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post a question, comment, or photo on the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have a couple photos there that we will talk about in just a minute, but first, this information. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Happy to be spending Thanksgiving with you and with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright talking about birds. And Bill and Noel, there are some photos up on the Facebook page. One is the baby bird that Pat was describing earlier on the air. And if you take a look at that, what do you think?
You asking about the oriole?
No, above that, actually. If you refresh.
I'm more excited about the oriole.
Okay, well, we'll get to the oriole, I promise. But first, you have to do your work first on Pat's baby bird.
Okay, I'm going to have to refresh it and go back, so
okay.
I can help you right now.
Okay, you know, it's
I see right here. This is, he's got his head tucked back.
Exactly.
Yeah, what you have is a goldfinch.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty exciting.
And this is a, looking at the wings, it looks like a first-year male.
Okay.
A little bit of yellowish on the back of the head. The wings look pretty, almost jet black. Females have this color, but the wings are more grayish.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like a young male born this year, hatched out.
And it looks like he's missing some feathers right at the, if I'm looking at it correctly, looking at the back of his neck.
Well, that could just be roughed up a little bit.
Okay.
The head is twisted and
yeah.
to the left and down. But, yeah, it may have just been from, you know, laying there or even, you know, whether it's just weathered, whether it fell down,
mm-hmm.
died from something, or was molested by a possible scavenger.
Well, and this one is still alive, correct? Right.
Oh, okay.
Pat's was still alive, yeah.
Okay.
As far as we know.
Tucked back like that, yeah, it looks like he's ailing a little bit. But that's a goldfinch.
Yeah, that's what I thought, and that's pretty exciting because I'm not the best bird identifier in the world, but I've been seeing actually a lot that look like that around our feeders, and I just refilled our finch feeders, so they've been around quite a bit. Well, you guys were very excited about the juvenile orchard oriole that's a little lower. Mary posted, is that a juvenile orchard oriole?
Well, I got excited when I first looked at it because I thought it looked... It's so yellow, orange, or mm-hmm. especially yellow, to be an orchard. Orchards tend to be a little greener than this. But the more I look at it, it probably is. I thought maybe it might be a hooded oriole.
That was what I was looking at, too. But also hooded, you can just see the edge of the wing, and it's got a little bit more prominent wing bar on it.
Right.
And, yeah, I was thumbing back through a book, too, because we do occasionally get some of these orioles out of the Southwest that will make it into Wisconsin. We've had a few records, but yeah, I was just like Noel. I was kind of excited about it. I'm leaning toward a young orchard oriole. He's looking straight at you, so a little hard to see the wing bars on it.
It's really a wonderful picture.
It's a wonderful picture. I agree.
And I think maybe the way the light is catching it, that it's a little bit more yellowish, perhaps just that lighting and that accent with his head up, that it's reflecting a little bit more. As Noel said, they tend to be a little more greenish.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, thank you so much for posting that. And as I said, anyone can take a look at what's up on the Facebook page. You don't have to even have an account on Facebook to look at what's there. So it's The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. You can just Google that together.
And a location and date for that would help also on the oriole.
Okay, yeah. Mary, if you put that up, we'll share that with Bill and Noel. And let's go back to the phones. Therese in Green Bay. Hi, Therese.
Good morning. This is one of my traditions to listen to your show every year.
Oh, thanks so much.
While I cook and the rest of the family is off visiting other relatives.
Oh, there you go. Thanks for spending Thanksgiving with us.
Thanks. The question about, I'm in the Green Bay area. There's a conservancy off the East River. I was snowshoeing late last winter and came upon four long-eared owls roosting in a very thick branches, and I'm just wondering what my chances of seeing them there in the same spot this winter.
And Bill and Noel, what is a long-eared owl? I have not heard of that.
That's always a great find. They tend to have a little bit of a communal roost, so that it is, I guess, not unusual to find more than one clustered little tree. It's a very tall, slender owl, named, of course, for those long ear tufts on the top of the head. Those, of course, not the ears, just the ornamentation on the bird. Looks a little like a great horned owl, but much skinnier and more stretched out. I would say any sighting of long-eared is always a good one. They have been known to come back to an area, but, you know, it's a hit-and-miss thing whether you're going to catch them again in the same place. But just the fact that you even found them, I mean, congratulations. That was a great sighting.
Yeah, as Bill mentioned, they very often will gather in a a few numbers, small numbers. They used to be more common. You used to be able to find them in some of the Milwaukee County parks, you know, 8 or 10 in a grove of conifers, which is where they usually roost in. So they do roost communally, and they're pretty susceptible to, you know, disturbance. So, you know, be very careful and don't tell a lot of people. And, in fact, that's one of the species that we do not advertise. We talked about communication earlier. We do not advertise location of long-eared owl roosts just because they are so susceptible to disturbance, mm-hmm. and they are a pretty uncommon bird. It's one of the species we probably understand and know the least about in Wisconsin. They were extremely hard to document during the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. I did have a report just this week of a bird that was found near the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve in Ozaukee County, and it was turned into a local wildlife rehabber who specializes in birds of prey, and she was able to release it back. So they are around, but where they, as Bill mentioned, where they would show up next year, it's a good chance, but certainly not guaranteed. And just don't get in there and disturb them a lot, because they are very susceptible to this and might abandon the roost completely.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Therese. And Beth in Waukesha is on next. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a brother who lives in western Waukesha County in a subdivision. He has about an acre. There are a few homes in his area. And he has been trying to put up bluebird houses for the last couple of years. And he keeps running into problems with, I believe, they're cowbirds that come in and do either eat the eggs or kick the baby birds out. Is there some formula or some, how do you deal with this problem of these invaders coming into bluebird houses?
Well, and actually, Bill and all, I'm going to ask you to hold that that answer until after the news, and we will definitely get to that and much more. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about birds with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. We'll be right back. Thanks again for spending at least part of your Thanksgiving with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, talking about birds with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. Bill recently retired as a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. And Noel is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And we really appreciate them spending so many holidays with us here on The Larry Mueller Show, but especially Thanksgiving. I've heard from a lot of listeners that this is their favorite bird watching show of the year. So thanks to both of you.
Happy to be here. And I just see you put the map up of the snowy owl on your Facebook
page. We did. So the site to track snowy owl sightings in Wisconsin, actually it says in the upper Midwest, is up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So we're really happy that you were able to share that with us, and we can share it with our listeners. We have some folks that have been waiting a little bit to get on to talk with you. So let's go to Alice in Crawford County first. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I'm glad to have you take my call. I had a question about the behavior of a cardinal. He started last summer in nesting season, and our car was parked outside, and he sees himself in the mirror, and he starts fighting that. And then when we put the car in our garage in the basement, then he comes around to the windows in the house and looks in, and if he sees his reflection, he tries to fight it, but if he don't, he'll stand on the sill and look in. And then we got two stainless steel chimneys that come up to our roof, and I hear him up there picking on the chimney, must see himself in there.
So
and he did this in the nesting season. And then after the nesting season was open, he stopped doing that for a long time. But then about 3 weeks ago, the car was parked outside, and he started that up again. I put the car in, and he goes into the windows and up on the chimney. And he's just there early every morning and all, you know, off and on all day. And I've never had this experience before this year.
All right. Well, let's see what Bill and Noel think of that. Noel, why don't you start?
Well, you have diagnosed with the situation. The bird is seeing its reflection in the metal or in your glass, and it's trying to shoo that intruder away because he thinks it's another cardinal. They're very territorial. Most species are, not all, but most are. and that's how they can ensure that they have enough space for to nest and raise a family. And in the springtime, when the hormones start rising in the bird, they became very defensive of the area, and they're trying to chase that bird away. Sometimes in the fall, there'll be another period where the hormones rise a little bit, and that's why you can hear birds sometimes trying their song out in the fall, and they may start this behavior again. But it's primarily related to the breeding season. It's interesting, cardinals, unlike many species, a female also defend the territory, and I've actually had female cardinals flying into windows too, trying to chase that other female cardinal out of the area. So very often you can you park your car, you can cover up the window. I mean, sometimes it's kind of hard and can be quite annoying.
Wow, well, that's an interesting thing to be able to observe, Alice. And I was just reminded that we left a question hanging.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was feeling badly that people have been waiting on the phone. But the question was, bluebird houses and how to keep non-bluebirds out of them.
The best suggestion I would have is to go to the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin website. There's some great information on plans for building the boxes, how to deal with competitors and predators. There's a good summary there. And one of the hard policy decisions for the organization is what to do when you get house sparrows in there. And the fact is that house sparrows and bluebirds do not mix. And basically, you know, you're going to have to remove the house sparrows. Now, he mentioned, or your caller, sorry, she mentioned the cowbird.
Mm-hmm, specifically, right.
Yeah, they don't usually get into those boxes. The holes tend to be a little small for them. If you make that the entrance hole a little smaller, you may be able to exclude them. They're usually looking more for the open cup nests. Cavity nests are not unheard of, but certainly uncommon.
All right. So sorry about not getting to that immediately, but there's the answer now. Bill and Noel, if you want to refresh your computers to look at the Facebook page again, Mary posted another photo of that oriole and said that she took the picture in Big Bend, Wisconsin on May 17th, so in southwest Wisconsin. She says she has a lot of orioles, birds in general, and she had three nesting pairs of Baltimore orioles on her property. This one hung around for about a week eating, thought it might be a hooded, hard to tell, and this shot is actually more of a profile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this one looks a little bit more like an orchard, and you look at the wings, that the bill is not, the hooded has a really large bill, and it's a larger bird overall. It's like an inch bigger than an orchard oriole, and tends to kind of have a down-curved bill. And if you look at the coloration on the one she just posted, I'm sure it's an orchard oriole now, and it really helped. Thank her for sharing that.
Yeah, again, a great
photo. Both of them are great photos.
Yeah, they really are. All right. Well, let's go to Josie in Sheboygan next. Hi, Josie.
Hi, good morning. Some time ago, I was living in this other apartment, downstairs apartment, and I had my bird feeders on my porch, and I filled it every day. And this is the first time this has happened. I see a bird only by its back, sitting on the ironworks of the porch, and I thought, oh, it's a dove, because it was the same color. And then I looked, you know, I kept looking at it. It looks bigger. And then it turned its head, and it had a little hook bill. And I said, oh my gosh, it's a hawk of some kind. Mm. But I don't have a computer, and I can't find my bird book, so I'm wondering what kind it is. And also, I'm French, and your last name is Poisson?
Yes.
Doesn't that mean fish?
It does. Good job. All right.
I just wanted to make that comment.
Sure. Yeah, well, let's see what Bill and Noel think about that bird. So it was a dove-colored bird, but bigger with a hooked beak.
Sounds like a kestrel.
Ah.
American kestrel is our smallest falcon. They will hunt insects commonly in the summertime, grasshoppers, crickets. Mice makes up a big part of their diet, and occasionally they may try to take birds, so they may be attracted to the feeder, so that might be that activity. Or the spilled food might have brought in rodents that, again, it might have used as a perch to be looking for. It is about the size of a mourning dove. In fact, when they're perched up on the wires, sometimes just in silhouette, you have to do a little double take to distinguish all of the mourning doves from the kestrel that may be perched up there. So that'd be my first guess.
So are kestrels the smallest raptor in Wisconsin?
Between that and the smaller of the male, which the males are always smaller than the females in birds of prey, the little sharp-shinned hawk, those two would be the tiniest that we have here.
Yeah, I think it would be the smallest, but as Bill says, a sharp shin, and that would be another possibility, even though I agree with Bill, it was probably a kestrel. You know, sharp shins love to feed around where there's bird feeders and small birds that they can then capture, and an immature bird would kind of have a brownish back, but it'd be darker than, say, the lighter gray that a mourning dove or a kestrel would have.
Mm-hmm. Well, merci for that call, Josie. And let's go to Millie in Waterloo. Hi, Millie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, sure. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I want to know, being a senior citizen on a fixed income who used to overfeed the birds, how do you feed the birds anymore? I always bought 50-pound bags and mixed my own food with other, mix it all up to give them a gourmet treat. And now just the sunflower seed is $30 a bag.
The sunflowers are especially expensive right now, right, Bill and Noel?
Yes, they are. There's a lot of competition for the sunflower oil market, my understanding, and it's going to be a shock when people go buy their first sunflower seed this year, because they're going to pay maybe three times more than you did half a dozen years ago.
So for someone like Millie, who'd really like to keep feeding the birds, but as she said, is on a fixed income, or for a lot of people, times are a little tight, are there any ideas of how to cut the cost while still being able to feed those birds?
Well, if you want to attract a variety of birds, you need a variety of food. So your cracked corn, millet, sort of a mixed bird seed, that works well for the juncos, tree sparrows, and a variety of birds. The black oil sunflower seed certainly is preferred by cardinals, and it tends to keep the house sparrows at bay. Safflower, of course, has always been known to be expensive, and even thistle seed for the small finches. One thing I would avoid, though, is don't try to go to just breadcrumbs and things like that. Don't give them junk food. I guess the best I would do is shop around a bit and see what you can afford to keep a little something out there for the birds, and maybe just take a look at your budget a little bit and see what you can. Yeah, it's not going to be as cheap as it was. The market has changed out there. Maybe cut back a little bit, put a little less out, and go with some of the mixed seed.
Yeah, I think people overlook corn, and it's probably not the favored seed it's certainly used by just about any seed eating bird. I put out corn on the cob for woodpeckers, and blue jays will come, and then cracked corn, as Bill said, is really good for the smaller finches and sparrows. And she might get to know a couple of deer hunters because, deer venison, they have suet associated with them too, or maybe become friends with her butcher that can supply her. She can sweet-talk him out of maybe some suet at the butcher shop to put out for especially woodpeckers and nuthatches and chickadees.
Great. And Millie may be asking if there's anyone you think might be putting you on their holiday gift list, maybe asking for some birdseed.
There you go. And Noel mentioned about the deer hunters out there. Well, there's obviously a lot of deer being harvested this time of year. One thing I know for people who butcher their own deer, if you're out in the countryside, it probably doesn't work real well right in the suburbs or hanging by your neighbors, but to take that rib cage and hang it out, a lot of the fat and gristle that remains on there, and the chickadees and woodpeckers will go for that.
Yeah, my children are grown now, but we still have the old swing set in the back, and I always put a couple of deer cages I get from deer hunting buddies, and they're used. They pick it up clean all during the winter, and it's great because it's up out of the snow, and hanging it up on it can't be preyed upon by mammals, so it's great for
it does chickadee. Work, but yeah, you'll be a little sensitive to the neighbors.
I was just going to say, you might want to see if you have any vegetarians living close by.
Put it in the far corner and somewhere where it's hidden from view. But the birds love it. It works.
Wow, that's great. I had never heard that before, so I've officially learned something new today. Well, thanks so much for calling, Millie, and happy Thanksgiving to you. And let's go to John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
I have a quick question. While I was waiting and I vacationed a bird, it would be this early fall, somewhat the color of more oriole, but smaller and very fidgety.
You know what, John? I'm sorry, but the sound on your phone is just not good. But I see that you were going to ask about whether heated bird baths in winter are a good idea, is at least one of your questions. Bill and Noel, what do you think of that?
Well, I keep one out.
For a while, but I'll let Noel handle it.
Okay.
Yeah, I keep a heated bird bath out for many years. Or from the backyard, I have one of the old kid saucers that I fill up and put on an old couple of tires. But in the wintertime, my wife just brought it out here in the last week or so and plugged it in. And so I do try to keep free water, unfrozen water available throughout the winter. But, it, you know, it's not a mandatory thing. But to me, it's kind of nice to see on a real cold day, a chickadee come down and take a couple of quick drinks or whatever. So it's just something else that you can do to help attract and hold birds in your yard area.
Well, and I definitely want to talk about how we can help birds get through the winter happily and healthily. But I first want to let people know that if they have a question about birds, call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bill Volkert recently retired as a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. And Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. They join us for many holidays and especially for Thanksgiving to talk about bird watching. And we would love to have you join in as well. So actually, let's spend a little time. You know, what we've talked about feeding and different types of feed, and we just talked about the heated bird baths. What else can we do to help birds in winter? And are there any special hints for winter bird feeding?
Well, as I said earlier, for a variety of birds and a variety of diets, I think the real trick is a variety of food. Get a little something for everybody. As Noel said, the corn on the cob, you can put that out there. You put a little food on the ground for the juncos and mourning doves and tree sparrows that tend to feed more on the ground. Suet works well for the woodpeckers and chickadees. The different kinds of seed out there, I would stay away from, certainly as I said earlier, some of the junk food, just the breadcrumbs or pieces of bread that tends to absorb a lot of moisture and is hard to digest. So try to get something that the birds are feeding on. And, you know, if you really think about it, like every animal, birds need food, water, and shelter. And we certainly provide a variety of food. We also, as Noel said, can put water out for them. And as I said, there has been some, I guess, debate about whether or not open water in sub-freezing temperatures is a concern. I think most people feel it is not. They'll go to freshwater springs, certainly, and drink and occasionally bathe in winter. But I think the one thing that's sometimes overlooked is just shelter. And I hear this a lot, especially people when they move into new neighborhoods. I put out feeders, I put out a bath, and I don't see much coming. Well, they need to feel safe. They need to be able to hide, find some shelter, come in, grab that food, and again, have some escape cover that they can get to. A quick fix, when you're done with Christmas, take your Christmas tree, stick it out there in the snowbank, provide a little bit of shelter for the birds at that time. And then take a look at your backyard and come up with your landscape plan. Think of shrubs and dense trees that you can plant out there over the years to make the backyard more bird-friendly.
And if you put that Christmas tree next to the deer rib cage, you're really in business.
You've got a full backyard.
Now, I want to make sure that we talk about the Christmas bird count and what it tells us about winter bird populations.
Yeah, it's starting December 14th and goes through January 5th. And these counts are, some of these counts have been going on for many, many, many decades. And they have, each count has a count circle point in the middle, and it's a 15-mile diameter circle around the center. And people try to go out in one day, try to identify all the birds they can in that 15-mile diameter circle. And in Wisconsin, there's about 100 of these circles that are surveyed every year, and some people will go on one. Maybe they live within one, and they can even just watch from their houses the birds coming to their feeder and contribute to the count that way. Other people go out while it's still dark trying to listen for owls. Other people will go out and drive the roads, and they're very often assigned a territory within this circle. So different towns are organized in different ways, but I know Bill coordinates a couple of counts, and I do too, and I'll probably be going on 8 or 10 different counts this year, and it's a good way we can get an idea of what the winter populations are, and we can track population levels, whether they're increasing or decreasing, and understand more about our birds by doing these counts.
And how can people get involved in that?
One, the easiest way is probably go to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website, just wsobirds.org.
And there's actually a link from the Facebook page for that, for the announcing the topic for today.
And there's a map on there that shows where a table with all the locations with, and a coordinator and a contact to find out when the date for your most local account will be.
Great. Well, we have Laura in Madison on the phone, so let's go there. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
What's your question?
So I was wondering, I live on the third floor of an apartment complex, and I'd really like to put out bird seed for the winter, but I don't want to worry about the birds pooping on my downstairs neighbor's balcony.
You're a good neighbor, Laura.
Because, I mean, I can clean my own deck off, but not so much theirs.
So you're basically saying, how can you feed the birds and avoid them eliminating right there on the spot? All right, so Bill and Noel, what do you think?
Well, I think there's a concern not only from the droppings but also the spilled food, which gathers down below, and it may even accumulate after snowstorms. You know, it gets a little buried, and so there may be a little bit of an aesthetic concern from neighbors that way. What I would suggest is put out a feeder and perhaps something with a perch nearby, and try to put it with something underneath it, a little bit of a catch basin. Noel said he uses for water an old saucer. Anything like that might be able to capture both the droppings and the waste grain, I think it'd be, kind of thoughtful for the neighbors so that your pleasure doesn't create a problem for them.
And actually, one of you mentioned, one of those saucers that's kind of like a sled. I mean, that would probably be a large enough diameter under a feeder to catch pretty much everything.
Yeah, and then just periodically clean that up. And, you know, that's the other thing I should pass on quickly comes to mind. When you are feeding birds in the wintertime, think a little bit about sanitation. And here we are luring birds in, but we always have a chance, as we're concentrating birds somewhat artificially, that you may get a sick one coming in. It's just like sending your kid to school with the flu. You can spread it to everyone else. There is a chance, as we concentrate birds around those feeders, that we may get salmonella as a bacteria that starts to spread. And WSO did a survey a number of years ago that found people tend to have these die-offs about once every 20 years. Best thing to do, when you have your empty feeders, periodically bring them in, soak them in warm water with a little bleach, disinfect them, scrub them down a bit, and then under the feeder, either throw snow on top of that waste grain and droppings that are there, or try to shovel that and rake it up a little bit, get it out of the way.
Great.
That way we make sure the birds are healthy and being helped rather than putting them in harm's way.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Laura. And Bill and Noel, we have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to get some ideas from each of you about good gifts for bird watchers on our holiday lists.
I need some of those too, Judith.
Well, we talked about bluebird houses and certainly feeders. And as Millie in Waterloo was saying, you know, the cost of bird seed has gone up a lot. So that's certainly something that would be nice to give people. I have a date with two little young friends to make feeders with pine cones and peanut butter and rolling them in seed that I'm planning on giving to some people.
That's a nice little craft thing you
exactly.
can share as well as you're making. A good bird book. You know, we always get questions about identification. Get a good reference so you have it, and keep it by the kitchen window where the feeder is, and take it in the car when you travel so that when you do see these birds you got a question on, you've got the reference available. And if you want to spend a little more, good pair of binoculars so you can see those birds up close.
Right. I know the National Geographic Field Guide has just come out with a new edition, and Tom Schultz, one of our Wisconsin local artists, has a number of pieces in there, so might be a nice one to pick up. It's probably updated the most with range maps and so forth, the National Geographic Society.
Well, I think those are all great ideas. And actually, one thing that we wanted to mention is that Wisconsin Public Radio is supported in part by Amazon.com, and a portion of all purchases on Amazon.com that begin with a search on our website at WPR.org/shop will be donated to Wisconsin Public Radio. So if people are thinking of shopping on Amazon.com, go through our link, and that way WPR will benefit from it. Well, we are at the end of our time today. So Bill Volkert, Noel Cutright, thanks so much for joining us as always.
Well, thank you. thanks always for having us.
It's a pleasure.
And have a great rest of your Thanksgivings.
You too.
Well.
And thanks to all of you for joining us today. Tune in tomorrow for Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Happy Thanksgiving.